is he, my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. And I'm calling you from the Sierra, so the snow is slowly melting here, but I woke up this morning to about 5 inches of it. It was quite beautiful. Finally, getting a little bit of winter here. Tonight, we have a beautiful topic. I'm really looking forward to this. This is a topic I don't have a lot of familiarity with. We're going to be talking about native or indigenous perspectives on the body, on sexuality, and the relationship of that to ceremony and dreaming. And my guest this evening is Philip Scott, also known as Chief Shunkawakan Sapa. He comes from the Lakota tradition, and he has been sun dancing for the past 20 consecutive years. I'm sure he's going to tell us a little bit about sun dancing. That I know something about, having some friends who have also been involved in that. But welcome to the Shame-Free Zone, Chief Shunkawakan Sapa.
Thank you. It's my honor to be with you today, share a little bit about our medicine ways.
Yes, absolutely. First of all, maybe you could acquaint the listeners who aren't aware of what sun dancing is, what it is, and why it is.
All right. Well, before I commence, I would like to just make a prayer and invocation and acknowledgement of the Creator and the ancestors and our beloved Mother, the Earth, from which we hail, all of us, and expressing gratitude also. You talked about the snow, and I'd like to express gratitude to the Thunder Nation for bringing the sacred rains here to California at this much-needed time, and really honored to have the opportunity to share with you and your listeners this evening, and pray that what we share is maintained in the sacred trust, and can acknowledge and respect indigenous nations throughout the world. So to answer your question, well, first of all, it's important for me to qualify that I'm actually of Salagi or Cherokee ancestry, and I'm a ceremonial chief in the Lakota tradition, and I have been sun dancing for 20 consecutive years. And it's an actual honor to do that. But the Sundance is a ceremony of sacrifice. And it, we prepare all year for the ceremony through purification of the mind, body, heart, and spirit. But the ceremony itself is actually 9 days long. And it's comprised of 4 days of purification where we participate in what are called inipis in the Lakota tradition, which means to live, which are purification lodges. It's a misnomer to call them sweat lodges. Many of us are trying to change that particular vernacular now. So it's a purification lodge. And it's a rather elaborate ceremony to detail. However, we use the inipis as a way of purifying, in addition to working through the preparation of the ceremonial site. And then on the fifth day, we sacrifice a tree in a very sacred manner, and it is brought into the mystery circle, which we have been preparing 4 days previously. And it's festooned with ropes and colorful prayer flags and ties. And of course, those prayers are for the people, for all of our relations. And then the tree is righted into the ground with obviously appropriate offerings and prayers. At which point, we commence the formal 4 days of dancing. And we dance from sunrise to sunset without food, without water. And in the course of those 4 days, in particular traditions, the dancer may have a vision to sacrifice his or her flesh. And so the chief will pierce the dancer through the skin, and it can be bone or wood or antler. And then through those skewers, the ropes that are tied to the tree are attached to the dancer. And then dancer then dances, pulling against the tree or hanging from the tree. You know, there's different dreams and different ways that the piercing and the fulfillment of that piercing can be realized. And the dancer eventually pulls sufficiently enough to tear the flesh. And then the flesh is given to the tree and to the earth. And kind of analogous to the stigmata in the Christian tradition, those open wounds become vehicles through which the powers of the universe, the creator, the earth, the ancestors, can flow through the dancer, who becomes like a hollow bone and can therefore be of service to the people in healing. Extraordinarily powerful ceremony. I think the most important message to convey to your listeners is to understand that both the sun dance as well as the hula from the Hawaiian peoples was banned by the United States government up until 1978, when Jimmy Carter created the Native American Right of Religious Freedom Act, which allowed us to openly worship and pray and reinstitute these dances. Obviously, the dances went underground so that they could be preserved and protected. But the powers that be at the time, in terms of the federal government and the missionaries and the Christian tradition and religion, perceived the sun dance as a gratuitous bloodbath and the hula as a lascivious dance of sexuality. And coming from a puritanical ethic, did not comprehend the magnitude and the power of each of these forms of dance. In our indigenous understanding, and this is ubiquitous, I've traveled the world and have spoken with other indigenous peoples as well, so there's a common understanding that what we really only have, or what we're bequeathed with here upon this earth, is our bodies, albeit temporarily, and our word. So both our bodies and our words are sacred and holy and need to be treated with the utmost respect. And you know, the body becomes a vehicle for worship, whether that be through participation in ceremony or through an act of union with another human being, or can be a vehicle for the expression of a culture, for sensuality in terms of language, you know, in terms of a revelation of the powers of nature and the beauty of our existence. So that's kind of in a nutshell the understanding of Sundance, as well as some of the political undertones to it, as well as the kind of philosophical ground of which we perform these ceremonies and these dances, because the intent is about healing. That's about medicine. So, in fact, in the translation of the Lakota phrase, we sacrifice so that the people and all of our relations may live. So the body becomes a sacred vehicle of worship and sacrifice. You know, analogous to what Jesus Christ did when he went onto the cross and also sacrificed his life for the people. And so this is something that we do annually each summer to the Sundance for the people.
How many people usually participate in the Sundance? Is it, and I don't mean the people, I know there's onlookers, but people who actually do the dancing, is that a small percentage of the people in attendance, or?
Well, generally depends on, you know, there is hundreds of dances throughout North America.
Uh-huh.
And some of the dances are very large, with comprising over 600 or more dancers.
600 dancers?
Mm-hmm. Some of the sun dances here in North
America. I would think you'd need more than one tree in that case.
No, actually, depending on the size of the tree, you can actually have, there's one tree in the center.
Wow. And,
many ropes are attached. So there are close to 600 dances at certain dances. And then there's also what are known as family dances. So they can be as many as, you know, 5 to 10 individuals. And then, of course, there's we don't necessarily regard them as onlookers, but they're supporters.
So okay.
They're individuals that will eat and sleep and drink for the dancers. Right, so that there's a relationship that's created by the supporters to help continue to support the dancers in their sacrifice.
So there's a couple of things. Maybe you could explain the concept of sacrifice. I think, you know, most people have been exposed to the word, but sometimes, you know, it's not necessarily a real vibrant part of our current culture. So how would you explain sacrifice? What's the concept behind that?
So the practice of sacrifice is one that involves an expression of gratitude. And I think that's probably why it's difficult in our culture, in the Western colonized culture, to understand the magnitude and the beauty of sacrifice. So if we understand that you know, that our lives don't belong to us, but that we are interconnected, and that each moment that we are alive and are actually given another day to walk the earth is a blessed and holy gift, then a certain attitude or sentiment of gratitude becomes a part of our lives. And a time comes when we walk our journey and fulfill our original instructions here on the earth, that there's a natural impulse to want to give back for the beauty and the gifts that have been bestowed upon us. And as I said, for Native people, you know, our word is very sacred. And the Lakota language, they say wakan, it is sacred. You know, so when we articulate vows, when we give our words to others, then we honor them. That's why commitment is such an important aspect of the sacred path. And then, of course, with our bodies. So when we can give our flesh and our blood literally for the people, that is also, you know, the body becomes a sacrament and becomes something sacred which we can give on behalf of others who are suffering. But again, the ground comes from an impulse to serve and an impulse to give back and to be an instrument in the relief of the suffering of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of an idea and a practice. You know, sacrifice is not just a concept or an ideology, but actually it's a way of life. And many holy peoples and awakened warriors, as I call them, from different cultures and traditions, have sacrificed on behalf of the people. So it's also an expression of generosity. When we can give without expecting anything in return, that is true sacrifice. Right? That is an embodiment and an epitome of selfless service without asking for anything in return. But is the ground of reciprocity, right? To be able to give without asking for anything back. And that is the beauty and the power of this ceremony, as well as other ceremonies of sacrifice.
So what kind of practices and ceremonies pertain to sexuality in indigenous cultures?
Well, it's a really interesting question. Actually, they're, you know, indigenous people, again, throughout the world and on my travels, are very humble and modest individuals and societies. There actually is very clear parameters around sexuality and ceremony that we actually do our best not to mix them. That said, because the body is sacred and vehicle for action in the world, that in terms of sexuality, it is a holy act. And so if we endeavor to make every action deliberate, then even in our sexual practices, we're going to bring awareness and presence to that sacred and holy union. But to my understanding, there aren't ceremonies specifically designed for sexuality within many different indigenous cultures.
There are or there are not?
There are not that many.
Okay.
Because in terms of energy, there's no distinction between sexual energy and other kinds of energies, right? It's just known as energy. So it becomes a matter of your intention as to where you deploy that energy. Yeah. So if we have energy that is expressed in a particular way, right, then that can be earmarked or directed towards the sexual practice, or alternatively, we can direct it into a ceremonial one. But we try not to, because the energies can be very similar in terms of the feelings that arise in the course of a ceremony, that we do have respect for that act. Interestingly enough, even during the Sundance, for example, in what I learned from the old-timers is that because of the amplified energies that occur during the Sundance, and in particular the Sundance they've talked about, when individuals were living in a tribal context, if a couple desired to conceive of a child, of course they weren't dancers, but they were supporters, then a sanction would be granted for them to conceive of a child on the third day of the dance. So while the dancers are, you know, in the evening, the completion of the third day of dancing, when the energies are very intense and profound, then a couple who is supporting the ceremony would be granted permission, if they so desired, to conceive of a child.
And this, all of this is in conjunction with sun dancing. Are there more private types of ceremonies that couples can practice? If, you know, indigenous couples practice, or is some of this that it may be even kind of rude for me to ask? I don't know. I think there are some native traditions that are not really for public consumption, but. So whatever it is that you could tell me about that would be great.
I think that if we understand, again, that we want to try to do everything with deliberate action, right? So unfortunately, I believe that, certainly one of the addictions that we have in the colonized world is sexuality. And it can be used in many different ways and can be also very dysfunctional. And so if we regard union as also a sacred and holy act, then there's a level of reverence that we bring to it. You know, generally when it comes to couples and families, you know, there may be personal ceremonies that are performed, but that's, again, not something that I am privy to able to share. However, I think that if we understand that there are two individuals that bring a intention that is deliberate to sexuality, whether that be in the conception of a child or even in an act of passion, then there's a very different element to that engagement, to that involvement. And what happens is there's an amplification of energy, whereby if in the case of two people who consciously and deliberately choose to bring a soul into the world, then the amount of energy that is invested by both of them will actually unite in that passion and allow that soul to be of a higher level of vibration. Whereas if people are committing a sexual act without that level of awareness, then the consequence of that is that the soul will be will vibrate at a lower level of awareness and frequency, right? So also, in addition, if a particular ritual, and this will kind of tie in dreaming here for a second.
Okay.
If a couple is able to dream together, and dreaming is also a very sacred act, where lying next to one another, they can connect in the dream time with each other and receive instruction from the spirits about a personal ritual that they can engage in either for the conception of a child or for their passion, then that ritual also becomes a reflection of devotion and reverence, and therefore the sexual act, whether it results in conception or not, will actually feed and nourish the couple and also amplify the energy of the soul that comes into the world. I don't know if this is making any sense, but...
Well, I had a clarification question to ask, which is, does any of this relate in any way, shape, or form to something some people refer to as sex magic? There seems to be the idea that, sex is a very powerful energy. So some people, think that they can affirm some of the things that they want to pull into their life. If you talk about giving birth to a child, I was just in a little mini workshop about sex magic 2 days ago, and it was about, she talked about, doing sex magic like you are giving birth to a creative baby, so not a human baby, but a creative baby.
Yeah, I'm not quite familiar with the term sex magic before or what a creative baby is, but I guess, if I was essentially referring to the, the acts of creation. Now, I guess in terms of what you mentioned of a creative baby, I don't know if you're necessarily talking about a human being per se, but I believe that if we bring that level of reverence and holiness to an act of passion between two individuals that are coming together in a deliberate and aware fashion, then there certainly is the capacity for a dream, a creative dream, to emerge between the both of them as well, right? So, I mean, in certain other traditions that they use sexuality for creativity, then naturally something can come to fruition between the couple, even if it doesn't result in, in a child. So there's a way that they can unite to dream together, right, to bring some creative project or product to the world.
Right. Yeah, that's actually similar. I don't want to say that what you're talking about is in any way sex magic, because you're talking about something with a spiritual focus, and sex magic doesn't usually, it's kind of an energetic focus. But I do see some similarities there. Could you talk a little bit more about sharing dreams? And you mentioned something about laying next to each other to facilitate this. And I guess the first question would be, why would somebody want to share dreams? And then second of all, how does one do that?
All right, so if we understand that we're in a dream right now, you and I are sharing a dream. So if we have the ability to share our nocturnal dreams with each other, it allows us to have deeper connection in different realms. My late wife and I would often dream together. So we would lie next to each other in bed, and we would journey into the dream time. And there we would encounter each other and have adventures. And upon waking, we would then share our experiences. And often they were in absolute corroboration with each other. So,
wow.
You know, that's actually a very sacred gift that we both shared. And even after her passing, actually it was this month, back in 1999, several years after her passing, she would continue to visit me in the dream time. And we would continue to share and talk, and she would share her experiences on the other side. So the dream becomes a means for greater communion and connection with each other.
So, what do you think? What is your? Do you have a belief about dreams? Is it a parallel reality? Some people actually think the dream's more real than the life. I'm just wondering. Do you think people actually go somewhere?
Well, I definitely fall into that latter category. The mystery is comprised of many dream times,
uh-huh.
many realities, and our waking ordinary world is just one of many dreams. And so they're not necessarily parallel realities per se. They're certainly dreams that are parallel realities, but then there are dreams beyond this reality as well. And certainly when we drop our body and return home, and become an ancestor, we have access to dreams and realities that we are not privy to while we're still bound to a physical body.
So when two people share a dream, do you think that they've actually left their bodies and gone off somewhere together? Or?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, without equivocation.
Okay.
So you have
without
a dreaming...
equivocation, okay.
Yeah, you have a dreaming body. Right? So you have a physical body and a dreaming body.
Hmm.
And at night, and this is also what happens when you can see energy of people who are journeying, right, during, say, shamanic journeys. The energy body or dreaming body will leave the physical body, and it is attached to the physical body and anchored by a tether. Amongst the San Bushmen and the Kalahari,
yes. Uh-huh.
They call it roped to God. Right? So during their sacred trance dances, which are also healing ceremonies occurring at night, when they collapse in the course of the trance dance, they also experience a separation from their physical body. So their dreaming body, or the Toltecs call it the double will leave the physical world and enter into other dreams and other realities where it encounters ancestral spirits, benefactors and allies that live in these other dreams and other realities. And they communicate with them, you know, just like what the shaman will do. Right? He'll leave the physical body, enter into these other realities to make contact with the spirits and the denizens of these realms, communicate, and then bring this information back for the benefit of the tribe. So similarly, when we journey at night in our nocturnal dream, it's exactly the same. We leave our physical body and go into these other realities, and then we return. And you can actually see energetically the return of the body, return of the dreaming double into the physical body.
How so? How has that been documented?
Well, it certainly hasn't been scientifically documented.
Oh, okay.
But if you are a seer, if you're endowed with the gift of the ability to perceive energy,
right.
Then it is actually quite palpable and observable.
To watch the, what you call it, soul or the spirit? To leave the body?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. And go into another realm of reality. So do you think that's, you know, for all of our listeners, like when they go to sleep tonight, that's going to be true for them, that they're going to actually be leaving their body and traveling somewhere else?
For every human being.
For every human being. What about all our relations?
Animals too, actually.
Okay. I was going to ask, you know, what the native beliefs about that were too. Does everything have a soul?
Everything has an energy body, and a soul.
Everything has an energy body.
I want to be careful about soul because that often implies a, you know, a Christian theological orientation. So
yes.
There's different words to describe, you know, essence or one's energy body. So as long as we're not just talking about a Christian soul, you know, then we can certainly.
Yes.
Speak about the energy.
I'm definitely not referring to a Christian soul.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to use any word that works for you. Yeah.
There's a life force. And similarly, you know, I've done a lot of hospice work. And the process by which the energy leaves the body at the moment of death is the same, only that little tether is severed from the body, so the anchor is no longer present, right? So, whereas, if you can see the analogy as the body is an anchor or someone holding a string, and the kite is the energy body or the double that goes to these other realms and realities to interact with the forces that exist there.
Okay.
The beings that exist there, right? So,
right.
In the case of death, then the string is no longer connected to the person holding it on the ground, right? And so, therefore, the kite can fly free.
True. So, what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm not getting this right, but what I'm hearing is that we actually die every night.
Close.
Yeah.
The only thing that's keeping it. So, I mean, if we look at we're actually dying every moment. I mean, if we really understand what's happening, right, we're actually living and dying simultaneously, right, moment to moment. But you are quite correct. So in the forms of meditation and fasting and ceremony and sleep, these are all means by which we approach death.
And so,
if we understand the physiological changes that take place, so let's look at sleep and meditation. So the heart rate slows, the breathing, respiration becomes quite shallow, right? There's actually a slowing of the metabolic processes within the body, right? So all of these are getting closer, approximating death, particularly in sleep, right? Which is why it's no curiosity that actually many individuals will slip away in their sleep. They pass away in their sleep. Because that tether, right, that thread is so thin that it can separate from the body.
Huh. Okay. Very interesting. I find that very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so would this help people feel less fear about dying?
Certainly. I mean, if we understand that life is a preparation for the journey, right? I mean, essentially all fears that we have in life can be percolated down into one, namely the fear of death. Whether that be the actual physical death.
Uh-huh.
Some people say they're not afraid of that. You know, but it could be the annihilation or dissolution of the ego.
Right.
So there could be a psychological component to their fear. But if we truly embrace impermanence and understand the truth of existence, then we make peace with our inevitable demise. And in fact, you know, the reason why there's many, both indigenous as well as Buddhist colleagues of mine, and we all kind of agree that the reason why there's so many individuals on this planet right now is because many have forgotten how to go home. They keep recycling here. And if you are familiar with the landscape of death, or at least understand that there's a reality beyond this one, then you will prepare yourself to depart from this earth and not have to return. Right? So your life becomes a preparation for the journey afterwards. And, you know, to tie this back in with our motif here, when two individuals unite in sexuality, and do so in a very deliberate, passionate, and aware fashion,
okay,
then there's a taste and an experience of unity consciousness. And that's what also can be experienced at the time of death. Right.
So, as unity consciousness.
Say that again?
What can be experienced at the time of death is unity consciousness.
Sure. A unification, coalescence with all of creation.
Right. So that, and that would be a very beautiful thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What other applications are there in sharing dreams? And what if somebody wants to try to encourage that? What is there anything they can do to encourage? You know, I know some psychologists will tell you if you want to remember your dreams, put a journal on the nightstand next to your bed. Then if you wake up from a dream, you're more likely to pick up the pen and, you know, write something down. So in that sense, people kind of learn to remember their dreams. And sometimes it can
almost seem
like...
It actually requires energy.
Huh?
It requires energy to remember your dreams.
Okay.
And so through purification processes, sacred traditions, actually through awakened sexuality, these are all ways of enhancing your energy and increasing your energy to be able to remember your dreams. So the simple act of placing a journal by your bedside is no guarantee that you'll remember your dreams.
Okay.
Right? But what you can do, there's actually certain practices that I'm not at liberty to disclose. However, there is a possibility for me to share. If you articulate a clear intention before you go to bed,
mm-hmm.
right? So regardless of whatever your tradition is, to essentially set an intention or to pray, petitioning the ancestors, the creator, the earth, to bless you with good medicine dreams.
Uh-huh.
And the capacity to remember them in the morning.
Okay.
That's an important qualifier.
Yes. Right. Doesn't do you much to dream them if you can't remember them.
Exactly. So that particular act can magnetize the possibility of remembering more dreams. And, of course, then it requires patience. You know, I have advanced training programs where we address dreams in a very specific fashion, where certain protocols are explained and given to enhance one's ability to dream.
Mm.
So, you know, for any of your listeners who are interested, you know, I do share and teach indigenous medicine and shamanism at my center. So,
and they can
interested.
Contact you through your website, right, which is ancestralvoice.org?
That's correct. And they're welcome to email me at Philip with two L's at ancestralvoice.org as well. And I have an office number 415-897-7991. So these are all three methods by which they can contact me for further information about any of the information that we've been sharing this evening.
for our listeners, of course, you know, some of them might actually be indigenous themselves, but probably a large percentage of them are not going to be. And I think sometimes the question comes up, does one need to be native in order to participate in some of the ceremonies pertaining to different indigenous cultures? Is it in any way insulting or in bad form to want to learn about native ceremonies when you're not actually a native individual?
Again, it depends on the tribe. I'm of mixed ancestry, so my altar is open to everyone. All races, all orientations, genders. There's no discrimination at this altar. There are indigenous peoples where there are closed altars, so only indigenous people are permitted to participate. So it's just about respect, right? So we are all ultimately indigenous, and it's certainly my conviction that our survival as a species is contingent upon remembering how all of our ancestors dwelled in right relationship with the earth and the sacred. So, I teach all people, and I believe that as long as you are willing to be humble and learn, because indigenous cultures are often antithetical to cultural colonial values. And so, like, for example, that, you know, if people come to ceremony that, they're wearing modest, respectful clothing, right, that, that they actually, as I said, indigenous people are very modest and humble. And so, actually in certain ceremonies, I remember a medicine man long ago when I was first on the path, my wife was participating in a ceremony, and he came up to me and he said, "I just want to remind you that, remember, in ceremony, this isn't your wife. This is your sister," right? Implying that it's not appropriate, you know, for us to be, you know, sexual with each other in that way, since she was directly involved in the ceremony. And I was actually in a support capacity at that time. So, again, to have a certain degree of respect for, you know, how cultures operate, you know, not to bring our own agendas or cultural values into the mix, you know, because that's really how we can learn, is by being open to other ways of being and living and perceiving.
You know, that brings up an interesting thing, because you yourself are of Cherokee ancestry, but I'm sure you teach people who have no documented ancestry. Is this objectionable to any of your contemporaries, or is it an issue in Native culture?
Well, let's just say I haven't had many objections. I've had a few. Again, you know, for those that espouse a more exclusive position, or I think it's also important for me to clarify that actually I don't teach Cherokee medicine ways, because, you know, I was actually introduced to the Lakota. My first medicine teacher was Ute in Pueblo. So I did not have any exposure with the Cherokee ancestry. I only learned much later, after being on the Red Road. I made a commitment when I was 17 to walk the Red Road, the Native American way. So I was very young. Of course, my dreams started even earlier. So my first medicine dream started when I was 6 years old, and I had a near-death experience when I was 7, which really proved for me the reality of the dream time. Through my dreams, and, you know, that this is really only the ordinary world is just one dream of many. Because my dreams are as real as me speaking to you right now, right? So when I speak with the ancestors, or I communicate with my wife, you know, I can touch her and and experience her and the ancestors as I'm communicating with you and, you know, engaging with other human beings on this plane of awareness. So the dream time is equally real and viable and has its own laws and its own rules.
Hmm.
And I mean, even the Aboriginal people of Australia believe the dream time is also as real, if not more real, than the ordinary world. And so we have an opportunity, you know, to connect through the dream. And so from 6 until 17, I was being taught in dream time by my ancestor spirits. Of course, the ancestry is not just related to blood.
Right.
So I had spirits visiting me in a dream time, and then when I was 17, I made a formal commitment to walk the Red Road. And then went off to college and did the academic world and was called to dance professionally. And it was there that I encountered my first medicine teacher in the flesh. And
when you say you were called to dance professionally, what kind of dance was that?
Ballet.
Wow. This is really incongruous. A ballet dancer who is a sun dancer. Do you find that people are shocked when they hear that?
No.
No?
Dance, ballet was the, you know, because I grew up in, you know, Western colonial America, so
sure.
I did not have any exposure to powwows or sacred ceremonial dancing, but when I graduated from college, I wanted dance to be my spiritual quest. And so in a rather convoluted way, I found myself to the sun dance, you know, mainly through the encouragement and I was participating in ceremonies with my first medicine teacher, who was Yutin Pueblo, and from there I had a vision to sun dance and began to follow that dream, and it led me to the Lakota Nation and to family who took me in and adopted me.
And you said something about for a long, long time you didn't know much about Cherokee tradition. Has that changed? Have you become acquainted with that
as
well?
I'm far more conversant in it now, but it's only later in the latter years of my blood father's life that actually when I began to do some genealogical research. That, and this was back in actually the 2005.
Okay.
I began to search my blood ancestry and inquired with my father, who informed me that we had, in fact, Western Band Cherokee ancestry. So I have since that time done a little bit more research, but having been sanctioned to conduct Lakota ceremonies, I tend to remain faithful to that tradition.
So in our last few remaining moments, what are some of the messages you'd like to leave the listeners with? And for instance, you've given your contact information, but why might they want to contact you? For what purpose?
Well, to help them reconnect with the sacred and the earth, right? To understand that our bodies are sacred and that we need to respect and honor the earth, and that when we respect and honor her as well as respect and honor our bodies, then we're in right relationship, that we can do every act in a sacred and holy way, right? That lovemaking can be a deliberate, sacred and a passionate vehicle for union and expansion of our awareness, to bring reverence and respect to everything that we do, and that if we are privileged to be able to participate in indigenous ceremonies, that we become a humble participant and open to learning. And you know, in that sincerity, right, when people bring that sincere and passionate quest to learn
right.
in a good way, then, you know, the indigenous, the elders and the teachers and the mentors will see that, and that will serve as an incentive to share and transmit medicine and teachings to people.
Mm. Well, it sounds quite beautiful. So, okay, well, this flew by. We're out of time, believe it or not. But I just want to once again tell people that they can reach you at 415-897-7991. That's 415-897-7991. And your website, once again, is ancestralvoice.org. That's ancestralvoice.org. Anything else you want to say before I sign us off for the evening?
Well, it's been an honor to speak and share with you and talk story, as they say in Hawaiian. And I wish your listeners lots of blessings in this new year of called the Black Water Dragon in the Asian astrological calendar.
Right.
And I wish everyone a blessed and sacred balanced walk in their life.
Thank you. And Chief Shunka Wakan Sapa, would you like to give us a closing blessing?
Thank you. Hoi tum kashila wakan tanka. Tatiatopa wiyok peata waziata wionhia pata ito hagata in makha ushi honwi. Shunka Wakan Sapa humbly expresses gratitude to the great creator, great spirit, ancestors, beloved Mother Earth, Grandmother Moon, and all of our relations. We thank you for the blessed gift of breath and life. I ask for Woyoshkin Vichozana, health and happiness to all of my relatives, the listeners here, as well as to Veronica, and I pray that you bless her on her journey, that she can continue to provide a forum for the sharing of sacred ideologies related to sexuality and the sacred. And I pray that this can be a time that we can unite in solidarity as a people and awaken to our responsibilities to take care of the earth, take care of each other, so that seven generations may flourish upon this earth. I ask and petition the ancestors to bless each and every one of the listeners and all of us with good medicine dreams that guide us on our journey of remembrance to be able to fulfill the original instructions that you have bestowed upon us, Creator, so that we can all be instruments in the relief of suffering of this world. I thank you for this way to pray, and I acknowledge the indigenous nations of this earth that continue to make sacrifices, and I acknowledge my family and my mentors who made personal sacrifices in order to protect and preserve this knowledge that it could be passed down to future generations with respect and dignity, that it can be disseminated in this time of great urgency in our world, so that all the children of this earth will flourish. I thank you for this way to pray, and I pray that the indigenous nations of this area, California, Nevada City, Bay Area, I thank them for the opportunity to share this medicine tonight and pray that they are pleased by what has transpired here, and that they, their own tribes and families will flourish and continue to self-determine at this time. We thank you for this way to pray, and that we as a species may come together in solidarity for the preservation of this earth, and that we can ask the ancestors to be with us in this time, and that they will listen and to know that we are not alone. Aho mitakoyasi.
Aho. Thank you so much for that blessing for the shame-free zone and all our relations.
Aho. My pleasure.
Been a pleasure to have you here.
I look forward to the opportunity to share with you again.
As do I. Thank you so much.
Take care.
And good night to you, and good night to our listeners from the Shame Free Zone.
And pleasant dreams.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian.